Hello and welcome to Essential Work, exploring the past, present, and future of jobs. This podcast brought to you by the Battle of Homestead Foundation. I'm Nathan Ruggles. Thank you for listening. Each week, we bring you stories and struggles, people and perspectives, interviews and commentaries, all on the world of work yesterday, today, and tomorrow. We look at the most important issues people face on the job through a unique lens of history and time and music. If you appreciate the crucial context that helps you better understand our particular moment in time, if you're a history buff, if you're curious about what the workplace of the future will look like, if you face your own challenges on the job, if you appreciate human-centered stories, if you're dissatisfied with news devoid of perspective, either grounded in the past or looking ahead, if you enjoy how music can provide an artistic window into issues, this is the podcast for you. Here in our eighth episode, we take a look at the most impactful and ambitious employment program in American history, the Works Progress Administration, or WPA. We talk with Max Page of the University of Massachusetts Amherst, a professor of architecture and director of historic preservation initiatives, as well as vice president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association. Larry McCullough will follow that up with a song recording that directly resulted from WPA initiatives. We'll, of course, talk the latest news from the Battle of Homestead Foundation as well. But first, Max Page and I review the powerful past legacy of the WPA, his proposal for a WPA for today, and a vision for what such a program could mean for the future. And this is Nathan Ruggles here back with you. We now turn to our feature interview with Max Page. Max is a MTA vice president out in Massachusetts, and he is also a professor of architecture at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His recent piece entitled "The Face of Mass Unemployment, We Need a 21st Century WPA" appeared in Labor Notes, and that's what prompted this interview here today. And Max is nice enough to join us. Max, thanks so much for coming on to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Nathan. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you today because this is an exciting topic in terms of looking back at history. And obviously, you outlined ideas for the present and the future in your piece. I'd like to start, though, to hear about how is it that you first came to write this piece about the WPA? Where did that come from?
You know, I've long admired the projects of the New Deal, the Works Progress Administration, and it has always seemed like a model we should emulate. And then, obviously, in the midst of this terrible pandemic and economic crisis, it's just come up again that this is such a logical thing for our government, our federal government, to do to help us get out of the economic crisis that's followed from the health crisis. So then I was offered a chance to write for Labor Notes because I am the vice president of the State Teachers Union in Massachusetts. We have 117,000 members. And I should note that we're in a state that has the highest unemployment in the nation. So people are desperate for work, which is exactly what the WPA was all about during the Great Depression.
So unemployment is certainly on the top of your mind, as well as other residents out there. And now, in terms of the WPA, certainly I've been fascinated with myself, and I'm right there with you as a model that we could learn from in the past. So how is it that you became interested in this history around the WPA in the first place?
Well, you know, a part of it simply comes from the fact that so many of the public buildings, so many of the parks and the pools and the museums and the schools and the universities that we inhabit in our daily life comes from that period. It's kind of remarkable how much still exists, still is central to the kind of infrastructure of our lives that comes from the New Deal. I mean, look, I take a walk down to my university where I teach, UMass Amherst. The main library, you know, now they built a new one, but they have the original main library was built during the New Deal. When I go over to Northampton, nearby town, or get on the main highway, Highway 91, you got to go over the Coolidge Bridge, which is built during the New Deal. I mean, over and over again, you just keep coming across places that were built back in the 30s and still shape our lives.
Absolutely. My friends joke that if there's a plaque around, I'm reading it. And those WPA buildings often have those old bronze plaques on them, right? With the, they're stamped or engraved. I'm not
sure.
They've
got the eagle, right? The eagle that was the symbol of those projects. Yeah.
Okay. Like the emblem.
Exactly.
Is like an identifying mark, is it?
That's right.
Okay. And I recall from, I did graduate school at the University of Akron, and actually the student union there had one of these on there and with Franklin Delano Roosevelt's signature impressed on the bottom as well, right? So what other, is there any particular examples that you, I mean, you've already given us some that are close to you, or is there any particular examples you like to share with us that you find particularly powerful, influential?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many. There are like 40,000 new buildings or structures that were built during just a relatively brief period, 1935 to 1943. And the WPA and other ones like it, like the Civilian Conservation Corps, they employed over the course of that relatively short time, upwards of 10 million people. So you'll see them everywhere. And I just like looked up what's in Pittsburgh, for example. And it just gives an example of the range of projects that were done in that brief period of time and the numbers of people that they employed. The Allegheny General Hospital, still there. The elementary schools, the Cathedral of Learning.
That is a very prominent location in Pittsburgh. You have been there.
I have. Yeah. Spectacular.
It is indeed. And so WPA project, yes. Very good.
The Highland Park Bridge, Homestead Grays Bridge in Pittsburgh, the Leamington Elementary School. The whole Pennsylvania Turnpike is a project of the New Deal era. So it goes on and on and on of these kind of basic pieces of infrastructure. By infrastructure, I don't just mean roads and bridges, but also our post offices. The Squirrel Hill Station Post Office, that's another one that was built during that period. Housing is just remarkable. I should also include other aspects like the Tennessee Valley Authority, which remains the largest power utility in the nation, all throughout Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, providing rural electrification to people who had never had access to it. That also was a product of the time.
Well, very good. Well, you mentioned bridges. I mean, bridges are also very prominent here.
This city
wouldn't exist without them. And so it is incredible over just an 8-year period then. So tens of thousands of projects and in such a range.
That's right.
Is quite impressive. And then everything from your post office, you said that the Tennessee Valley Authority, I mean, I can't, so that was a huge infrastructure. That's not just one site.
I mean, some of the, you know, a series of dams, I mean, that produced electricity that was distributed far out into the rural regions. I mean, it's kind of incredible, actually. It's like the list of the range of projects, I mean, 800 swimming pools, handball courts, tennis courts, parklands, fairgrounds, armories for the National Guard, gyms and auditoriums, and 1,000 libraries were built during that period. It's just kind of an incredible thing. You know, part of, you know, back to your original question, Nathan, like, why does it galvanize you? Why are you interested in this? It's because when we want to, we can build tremendous public projects.
Yes.
And many of them have lasted the test of time. And these are solid buildings that you still walk into for your, pick up your stamps or, you know, go to school or go to the library. We can do that if we want to. And because here we have the example of having done it in the past.
Well, and yeah, some of these buildings exist today and are utilized on a day-to-day basis. And we've literally built upon them the future. And this is, where are we? But 80 years now, right? Something in that neighborhood.
85 years since the founding of it in 1935. So it was actually part of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's, they call it the Second New Deal. So there was the First New Deal right after he came into office, 1933. And there were some initial programs, but frankly, they weren't really enough to kind of jumpstart the economy. And so historians call the Second New Deal, starting around 1935, where things like the WPA got going, and then things like Social Security and others really kind of revved up the economy much more and put a lot more millions of people back to work.
And something else you mentioned in your piece, it wasn't just physical buildings that benefited from the funds coming through the WPA.
Oh, yeah.
The arts and culture weren't necessarily restricted to an edifice, right? Or a museum or such, right?
Absolutely not. So some of the best loved parts of the WPA aren't buildings at all. Since the goal of the WPA was to put people back to work, they were put back to work in all kinds of areas. That include the Federal Writers Project, in which they hired great young writers to do the histories of different communities or to take oral histories of formerly enslaved people. Some of the most powerful kind of oral recordings of people who had grown up, who had been born into slavery, were done as part of the Federal Writers Project. And of course, there's also the murals that we see in many post offices and other places that were done by the Federal Artists Project. The list of kind of the artists that got sort of their start in the WPA, they were unemployed and they were given their start, are just incredible. I mean, some of the names I hope people will all know, like Mark Rothko, Philip Guston, Louise Nevelson, Willem de Kooning, Ralph Ellison, the writer, Saul Bellow, John Cheever, Richard Wright. I mean, these are some of the great writers and artists of the post-World War II period. They got their start working for the government, either, you know, teaching painting classes or writing histories of cities and towns. Whenever I go to a city, I usually try to get the WPA guide to that city. Obviously, it's changed dramatically, but they get deep into like the history, all the different types of people who are there, the cultures, the food. It's sort of a remarkable documentation about our country. So that's a legacy as well.
Oh, and those guides, so you pick those up at a local library? Is it online? I mean, where
well, do
you
some
find
of them,
these?
They're now all online. Now they are available all online, but many of them have been republished over the years, not updated, but reprinted. And so I'll often pick those up and I feel like I'll be reading some great writer that we came to know later, getting their start writing these very, really beautifully written studies of America.
Well, and it's interesting, too, you had mentioned at that time they might have been a young writer or a budding artist, but now, years later, they are famous and renowned.
And this is because
of the money that came in through the WPA.
Yeah, and it gave a real start to people. Some of the names that I just read to you, Ralph Ellison, for instance, Zora Neale Hurston, Jacob Lawrence, these are African-American artists. So that the WPA is often, the New Deal has been criticized because there was some overt racism that kept African-Americans out of some key programs and jobs. But in the terms of the kind of the Federal Writers and Artists Project, many Black artists got into the mainstream and got jobs and opportunity to practice their craft that they may never have had. And we are all the beneficiaries for that.
And you do address that issue. You do acknowledge in your essay that, unfortunately, you know, it was the 1930s. It was the 1940s. It was still in the shadow of Jim Crow. It was prior to civil rights, prior to the integration of the military, right? So, I mean, we're still living with a legacy of racism today. Certainly in that era, it was even more keenly felt. And unfortunately, it was reflected in this program, unfortunately, in the way it was operated.
It was. It's a double-edged sword. We have to acknowledge that. I mean, and this was partly the Democratic Party had a strong hold on the South. And there were a lot of overt segregationists, and the party was not willing to challenge that. But, you know, many civil rights leaders, like Martin Luther King and others, looked back and saw that a lot of the seeds of the later civil rights movement were found in the 1930s as part of the WPA. 250,000 Black workers got decent jobs through the WPA. There were Black leaders were hired into government positions in ways never before. There was a rise of unionization that was welcomed by FDR and the other Democratic leaders that would also help uplift African-Americans and Latino workers later on. So it is a double-edged sword. I don't want to at all brush away the negatives there, but I think even African-American leaders in the 40s and 50s and 60s look back on the New Deal as a place where some real progress was made.
So there still was, in many ways, a positive impact despite that it didn't fulfill perhaps the potential it could have, right, for certain communities.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and you do bring up another issue too, in terms of Is it fair to say that in terms of unionization and in terms of labor, was it a bit of a mixed bag in some sense?
Yeah.
I think you touch on that as well in your essay.
Yeah. Right? The WPA, many parts of it did not allow for unionization of its workers. On the other hand, overall in the New Deal, this New Deal era, this was a time when labor felt its power. That's when we get the CIO, which ultimately we have the American Federation of Labor. And then during the 30s, they created the Congress of Industrial Organizations. They would eventually merge. And then, of course, later, part of that second New Deal I was talking about that the WPA was a part of included what's called the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, which gave, it was sort of the Bill of Rights for labor that we still refer to and rely on for protection of unionization and labor rights today.
So that WPA, to kind of wrap up talking about the original WPA, it went for those 8 years and then it ended.
Correct.
So what was the story of how that wrapped up and the decisions that came about around that?
Yeah, so the key there is that World War II is what happened. And there was just the total investment in that war effort. And there, frankly, was not the need for the other kinds of job-making projects. Not that there was no more work to be done, but the sense was we had now achieved what we needed, and what we needed to do is focus all the energy on the war project. And, of course, that provided great, great jobs and investment by itself. But it was felt that the WPA was no longer necessary.
And it did achieve in terms of having the impact that was intended was that it came about in the Great Depression and it helped lift this country out of its greatest challenge in terms of unemployment it had seen at that time. Now, if we can bring things up to the present day,
sure,
which is a big focus of that essay that you wrote,
yeah,
is that we have a challenge right now in front of us, right?
We most certainly do. I mean, we have... I think I mentioned earlier, we have in Massachusetts 16% unemployment, highest in the nation, and many states are up in the double digits like that. It's just terrible. And at one point in Massachusetts, we were up at Great Depression levels of 20% or more. So it's not like there's not work to be done. This is the terrible irony, the tragedy of the situation is you have people who have been displaced out of work, and yet there's a ton of work to be done. And some of it involves repairing, fixing up the projects from the New Deal era. I mean, we have 50,000 bridges that are determined to be in suspect shape. Like, we could hire people to put them back to that kind of work. We have schools right now in Massachusetts. We have a huge issue. Schools, many schools were built back in the 30s or much earlier and need the repairs, need to be updated so they have HVAC systems that make educators and students feel safe. We can
sure.
train young people. We can put them to that work. We can repair all our school buildings, on and on and on. You can see how, if you just look around your own community anywhere, we could say, wow, there is a lot of work to be done because we've disinvested for so many years in kind of our public life. We just have not kind of put the investment in our schools and post offices and roads and bridges and sewers and parks. That's why I said that so often we're still living with things from the New Deal because we've never replaced them. We never haven't added to them. So now when we desperately need to put people back to work, let's just not leave them on unemployment. Let's say, hey, here's a job. Get whatever it is. People would be glad to do that. They gain employment. They gain skills that will, you know, allow them to continue on after this pandemic is over.
And certainly it's safe to say that we have this legacy from the original New Deal and WPA that we've literally built upon and has been a foundation, but you can't let that foundation just crumble away, right?
Right.
And we have, for a number of years, it's safe to say we have had this lack of investment that we're now, you know, those are chickens are coming home to roost, so to speak, right? Of that lack of investment.
That's absolutely right. It's really, I mean, I consider it one of the tragedies of right-wing thinking and politics over the past 30 or 40 years, which has been to disparage government, disparage the public life, to believe that the private sector can always do it better. And so we have impoverished our public life. And I mean that as all the range of things that we did in the WPA, not just the buildings, but also the kind of investment in the arts and culture that the New Deal represented. And so I think it's a ripe time
for us to invest in all those areas. Again, it would put people back to work. It would, I think, frankly, I mean, one of the things I write about in the piece is a long-term impact, is it would revitalize a belief in government. Part of the reason people maintained a strong belief in government in the 30s, 40s, 50s, into the 60s, was partly because of the evidence of what had happened in the New Deal era.
Sure, it was they right said, there yeah. in front of them, right?
Yeah, or they built it. They were part of
that's
it.
That's right.
Of the 10 million people I helped build right. this. They're using
with their hands.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And so you're like, oh, this works. This worked. It got me a job. I built something important. It's still being, my kids go to that school now. So that is, it's not ulterior motive. I lay it right out in the article that one of the goals is when you do a project like this, you give people a sense like, oh, government has such an important purpose. And that is why there would be such opposition from the right to this. Because they're scared, frankly. It doesn't pay profit to suggest that government, in fact, can provide, can build a vibrant society for us.
Absolutely. And you really hit upon something. I think that you can't overstate the significance is that when you have individuals walking around who can, like you said, they can point to a school building that not only they had a hand in building, but then their children are utilizing.
Yeah.
Or you have that writer that wrote that book and somebody read that book and cherishes it. And they know as a result of this funding, there's a museum with art hanging on the wall that they enjoy. And it creates a wonderful place where people can go as a result of this. And you have the tangible result of this investment
exactly.
in the public good, which is something that this idea of the public good, unfortunately, is something that we seem to have lost. And, you know, the recent conversations around the Postal Service as a public good, right?
Yeah.
Shows that there is still this inkling among folks that this is important, right? That
still have this feeling, Nathan, I think right? it's a little different. I think it's more yeah. than an inkling. I think you're absolutely right. There's been an attack on it. But mm-hmm. actually, when you ask the general public, they love the post office. They want yes. these kind of investments. They want national health care. They believe in these kinds of both investments and the institutions. So it's not lost. It's simply been shut out of power, is the way I'd put it. National okay. leaders, frankly, not just Republican, also it's infused a large part of the Democratic Party as well.
Sure it has.
And so that there's a disconnect between, I think, what people increasingly want and value and what our leaders are providing us. And that's why this election, but not just this election, but beyond, is so important, because I do feel like there is part of the culture wars are a debate over the common good. Although I will say that lots of places that are considered conservative, if you ask people the things that they value, it often ends up being some government programs that have supported them, and that's what they're looking for.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. And about that idea of the disconnect, it's like the idea of that, you know, you see a placard at a rally that says, get your, you know, government hands off of my Social Security,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
or
right.
something like where you right. have, again, a legacy of that New Deal era, the Social Security and Medicare following behind is, you know, the most successful government programs ever, right? Bringing people out of poverty. And people do love them. Like you said, people do believe in them, but there is this disconnect
yeah.
with those who are sitting in the halls of power and making these decisions
yeah.
aren't necessarily reflecting the wishes of the American people.
That's right. That's right. I think that's absolutely right. You know, I feel like there is this moment, though, this pandemic did lead to, at least initially, some major reinvestment to at least protect people, a series of bills. What's missing is kind of the bigger investment in our long-term health and security. So we passed in the early part of this pandemic several bills that at least kept people whole, you know, with expanded unemployment and health insurance and the like. I think the debate now is, can we decide that we're actually going to just to invest in people to build a more prosperous future? And the WPA provides an avenue, a modern version of that, provides a way for us to do that. Because we have so much work to be done in order to make us look again like a kind of a first world country. I think one of the things the pandemic revealed is we're not America first all the time. We're not, you know, the exception, exceptionally great in all areas. In so many ways, we saw the lack of public health, of an integrated system to care for our people, weak social safety net policies. Similarly, let's now take what's the best of our tradition and do it right this time.
Yeah, it unfortunately has been an indictment of our public health system or the lack thereof currently. And again, that idea of the common good or the public good, something that we all share in, something that we all value, something that we all benefit from. Now, I will say you did mention there has been some actions taken in the midst of this pandemic to lift people up. What would you say to those that would say, oh, wait a second, we have tax incentives, don't we? We've got unemployment insurance. Isn't that enough to get us through? Isn't that enough? Isn't the economy just going to bounce back and people will take the jobs they had before and everything will be fine?
Right. So the economy we had before, the booming economy, right? So we've had several years of this incredibly booming economy. Wages for working class people barely budged. And over the past 20 or 30 years, they have been in decline. We have this growing, enormous wealth gap. So when people say, oh, the tax incentives, they work, it tends to be the people at the higher end of the scale. It has been a great time for you if you're at the top of the scale. But
sure.
for the rest of the people, it has not been. And again, the kind of these projects, real hands-on projects, offer an opportunity to provide, especially if they're unionized, because when you have unions, you have a better pay for working people. It has a chance to lift up people who've been at the bottom and are falling further behind. This is really, I mean, it's been really a frightening period that even in the midst of kind of a era of a number of years of what looks like great growth and the flying high stock market, regular people barely seeing their wages budge.
Now, in terms of, you know, if you want to talk about shovel-ready projects, as they say, right, is there any in particular that you're aware of that you see that would be right at the top of the list to kind of jump into and take hold of that could really have a really strong impact in both in terms of unemployment and in terms of building up this country's infrastructure moving forward and as well as the economy? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, look, it is my business right now, but I think it's still accurate to say, like, invest in public education. I mean, we can put people to work in the schools, right? We have far, in so many places, have cut spending on public education, which is like the dumbest thing on earth for the success of a community, not just the individuals, but the whole country. That's been going on for years. Let's reinvest, hire a whole new cadre of young people to work in the schools. At the same time, hire another cadre of their graduates to go fix up the schools, to repair what was built so many years ago, make them both green and make them safe. Because you know what? This pandemic is not going to be the last pandemic. So why don't we get it right this time and clean up those buildings? Just that, hiring a whole new slew of educators, and many, by the way, are currently going to be retiring. So let's bring in a whole new cadre of educators, fix those school buildings. That's several million jobs right there. I would say one thing that we saw also in this is how we've allowed our hospital system, especially our public hospital system, to fall into disarray. We've allowed those buildings to fall apart, so we have far fewer beds than we should have for some kind of crisis like this. You know, we were just talking about a public health system. We should have a core of public health, a whole like cadre of an army of public health people to go out and provide public health across the country, not just during a pandemic, but during regular times. Because if you catch health issues much earlier on, then you don't have the huge expenses that has driven up the cost of our healthcare system. Those are just two areas, but I could go on and on. I mentioned bridges earlier. I mean, we have the very fabric of how we connect, how we get from place to place, how we go over rivers, how we transport ourselves. We know it's in disarray. And so let's invest in that. Then finally, I would say housing, right? We have, for so many working people, the lack of housing and lack of quality housing is just appalling in a wealthy nation like this. And a lot of public housing was also built during the New Deal period.
Well, you certainly, I don't think we get an argument out of folks in Pittsburgh around the idea of bridges, because they're everywhere, and we wouldn't be able to function without them. And, you know, when you mention education as well, so every state probably in the whole union right now has a challenge about funding education right now. With all the taxes coming in have declined, federal funding has not replaced it. They're in budget crises right now, figuring out how they're going to balance their budgets, which most of them are required to do, right? And unfortunately, we have already underfunded schools are likely going to be on the hit list, right? So an investment that you're talking about is, what better time than right now when states and schools really need to see an influx of support and investment?
That's absolutely right. And we should note that if a city or a town or an institution wants to invest, like, interest rates are basically zero right now. Like, this is the perfect time for any kind of locality to say, yeah, let's start building. You know, what you raise, Nathan, is an important question, though, is like people are saying, oh, we don't have enough funds to do this. We don't have money for the federal government. We're in, obviously, state revenues are down. That's absolutely true. But it's also our own self-inflicted wound, because most states, I'm sure it's Pennsylvania too, certainly in Massachusetts, have been over the past 20 or 30 years in a tax-cutting mania. Massachusetts, for example, if we just reverse the tax cuts, not raise tax, just reverse them and went back to the tax rates we had in 2001, we would have $4.5 billion more. That's about 10% increase in our state annual budget if we simply reverse tax cuts. And I just happen to note that Pennsylvania's got 10 billionaires in your state, right? Those 10 billionaires have been getting very wealthy. I know in Massachusetts, we actually have 19. Well, certainly. I would say they saw their wealth increase by $17 billion in the past 6 months.
Incredible.
So what I always bristle if anyone ever says, well, there's no money. I'm like, there is money. The question is whether it's where it belongs. And that, so along with the WPA project, you'd need to raise the funds. And the best way to do it is through federal, very progressive taxation, a wealth tax, such as was proposed by Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, and use that to invest in regular people.
Well, and certainly, you know, we've seen a tax cut under this current president. We saw another tax cut back in the early 2000s under Bush W. And both of those, certainly so much of the benefits going, you know, cutting those top rates for the wealthiest among us. And if you want to go back to not quite as far as that New Deal era under the very liberal president Dwight Eisenhower, with the top end as a 90%, and you know, it did go down after that, but still twice as high it is now on that type rate, and it was certainly a different situation then. So we do need to wrap up, but I do want to ask, in terms of how, so you've laid this idea out and you've given a strong argument for why this is how we should proceed. So in terms of it and happening, and what is it going to take to see this get through a Congress and put on a president's desk who's going to sign it? What do you see as some of the elements that would need to happen to see that through?
Well, it's not guaranteed, but obviously the election on November 3rd might make a difference, because I think Biden-Harris administration would be more open to this. It would not guarantee it. But the kinds of investments that they're talking about, including in things they're not quite on board with the Green New Deal, but similar kind of investments in environmental repair in this country, to the variety of other investments that they've claimed they want to make in public education, for example, and healthcare, they would be open to a proposal like this. And a number of economists, I'm just following the lead of other economists who have said we need a dramatic investment to get this economy going again. And that, in fact, something like a new WPA is on that list. I know the Roosevelt Institute in New York has had this in mind as something that is that is necessary for us. So I see it, the way politics works is it seems impossible right now. An election, depending on what happens in November, and, you know, if people get organized and pressure, suddenly you could see a major, major action like this. And I think once it was undertaken, it would be so popular far and wide. It would bring jobs and development to the entire country, and not the kind of rapacious development that we've been used to, where we sell off private lands and toll roads to private companies rather than keep them as public good. I mean, FDR was very committed, for example, that utilities remain public. And now we just assume that we're going to get all our power from private companies, when he said, no, these are our resources, our national resources, the power to run our country that must remain public. So we have a strong tradition. That's partly what I'm excited about, is recapturing a tradition. It's not a wild-eyed invention imported from some other foreign country. This is our own country, and it's everywhere, as I said. And I would urge people to look at livingnewdeal.org, one word, livingnewdeal.org, and you can search every single town in the country and find out all the projects that were done as part of the WPA and the whole New Deal.
We'll be sure to put that link in the show notes for this episode. So you mentioned as far as having that grassroots support and that organization to make this happen. Do you see, are we going to be able to have that coalition between a variety of working folks, of unions, those not in unions, environmentalists? Is that kind of coalition possible? And is that what's going to be needed to get this through?
Yes, I think it is a coalition. I mean, I think there's a lot of people on the further left part of the spectrum who, of course, want someone like Joe Biden to be elected, but thinks like on day one, we're going to have to push him. But I think there's some fascinating mergers of groups that have sometimes been opposed. I mean, the Green New Deal was really an effort to bring some building trades unions, that workforce together with those wild-eyed environmentalists. And there is so much in the Green New Deal that is for the building trades, because it's yes. incredible possibilities for actual building work if we're to green our country and make it environmentally sustainable. So I feel like there are real possibilities. No doubt there's going to be lots of clashes from different groups, but I think something like this can unify, because as we talked about earlier on, the WPA touched so many different areas, from oral histories to engineering documentation of historic structures, to building swimming pools, to building schools, to building roads and bridges. There's a lot of possibility under the basic idea to involve people who have different kinds of interests.
Max, as far as looking to the future, what do you see happening if we choose this path, say a decade from now? And what do you see would be the possible future if we choose not to do this at this time, or we choose not to go down this path of seizing this moment for something like a WPA?
Right. No, it's a very good question. I mean, look, I think we are in a very, very painful moment. And it's not just about who, the national leadership. I'm talking about there's a very sharp, sharp divide. And I think it's underlying that is the sense that a large portion of the population does not see a very strong future because of the enormous inequity. And so people look for somewhere to blame. I mean, rightly, they're looking for some culprit. Unfortunately,
yes.
This current president has said, look at the immigrant over there, that's to blame, or look for those intellectuals or finding people to blame and worse. Whereas what I see as the great hope of this is that we actually turn our attention away from who to blame and instead towards what we can build. And that I feel like you could imagine a decade from now when we see sprouting up everywhere a whole new era of building and writing and painting and teaching and curing. And I'm just positive of it, that it will generate both economic activity with more egalitarian economic activity. So I'm not looking for something like paradise in 10 years, but I think there can be a sense that, oh, we're on a far better path, and that if we start to reverse the inequities between the haves and have-nots, that has all kinds of positive ripple effects. And I think that kind of resentment has been that we are living with now, that I think comes from the economic inequality, the sense that we can't advance, that's at the root of so much. So if you start to reverse that, all kinds of good things happen in communities, between people, in our whole culture. That's my hope, that we, not that we achieve it, but that we start going in a new direction mm-hmm. that then kind of builds on itself.
Well, and it's certainly no coincidence that inequality that you speak of that has had this such a tremendous impact and tearing at the fabric of this country and of the working class coincided with that time where we stopped that investment 40 years ago at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so much of the infrastructure that you speak of. But this is, you're bringing the possibility of bringing us together with the best tradition of the past, with current ideas of justice and current ideas of green infrastructure. And I'm sure as an architect, the idea of seeing some fantastic new structures and buildings as a result of this must be a delight.
Well,
to
that's part of the work is hiring a whole new cadre of my students into the, you know, into the work of designing our schools and post offices and gyms and pools and everything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Max, thank you so much for joining
glad
us
to be
today
here. And, it's really fun.
And really appreciate talking to you and coming on the program.
Thanks so much, Nathan. I really enjoyed it.
And that was Max Page here with us with the Massachusetts Teacher Association and UMass Amherst. And we're back here to close out the program with our review of all the events coming up from the Battle of Homestead Foundation. And of course, our song of the week, based upon this week's theme. For that, we need to bring in our music guru, communications manager from the Battle of Homestead Foundation, Larry McCullough. Larry, thanks for being here.
Hey, this is great, Nathan. Thanks for having me. Got a good song this week. And there's a lot of events happening with the Battle of Homestead.
Yeah. So tell us what we got going on here this past week here with Battle of Homestead Foundation.
Well, we've got another Charlie's Monday Marker. And that one was episode 17, featured the colonial settler, Simon Gertie, who actually had a farm and a little stream of water called Gertie's Run.
And this is areas just north side of Pittsburgh and running north from here, correct? Here in western Pennsylvania.
Oh, he was all over.
Oh, he's all over.
Oh, he's all over. He's born in Harrisburg, and he lived in the 1700s and was quite controversial for his time. He was a scout and a trader, had a lot of action, interaction during the French and Indian War, the American Revolution. Eventually, after the Revolution, because he ended up at one point on the British side, he ended up in Canada. But he was really an interesting historical figure of the mid-1700s here in western Pennsylvania. I don't want to spoil anything else, but...
Yeah, you got to check out Charlie's Monday Marker to hear the rest of the story.
The rest of the story, definitely there on Charlie's Monday Marker. But all this month, Dr. McAllister has been focusing on indigenous American themes here. Queen Aliquippa, the mounds of the Seneca people, and Simon Gertie, who was one of those transitional figures that interacted a lot with Native Americans at a time when the empire of France and England and then the United States all came converging in this area. So there's a lot of really interesting things at this particular Monday Marker.
Excellent. Excellent. And yeah, of course, this theme being, you know, we just had Indigenous Peoples Day here for the month. A lot of great stories, as always, coming from Charlie. So everyone should check that out on YouTube. And he's on episode 17. If you missed any of the back episodes of that, they're all there right on YouTube. You can spend a lot of time listening to all these great stories. And if you are here in the greater Pittsburgh area or visit here in western Pennsylvania, you can check out any of those sites and see exactly what and where Charlie's talking about.
Definitely. Other than that, we just finished up our last program. We had six programs all online this year. Last one was with Mike Stout and his book, Homestead Steel Mill. I think in 2021, same thing will happen. We'll prepare for in person, but if they're online, they're online. And if you have suggestions, anybody listening now, let us know for speakers. Obviously, it's themes about work and labor and the history and heritage here in western Pennsylvania. But we had really quite a variety this last year, and I think we're going to get another variety of speakers for 2021.
Yeah, that planning is going to be taking place here next month for next year. So you can send an email out to battleofhomestead@gmail.com. Again, it's battleofhomestead@gmail.com. We'll put that email will be in the episode description. And let us know what you think of what we've done and what we should be doing. And I think we can also look for in the very near future, if you missed any of the past events, the monthly events that have been happening over the summer with the Battle of Homestead Foundation, those will be posted up in the future on YouTube. So you can check all those out. Really great reception from moving all these events online, hasn't it been, Larry?
Definitely. A lot of folks have tuned in from around the country, around the world, actually, which obviously they could not have done if we were holding them here in Pittsburgh.
If you head out to the website, battleofhomestead.org, you can get more details about all those past events, as well as all the activities of the organization in the past. There's a whole bunch of information about the actual history itself, as well as all the programming. And while you're there, please consider joining as a member. However much you decide to give will support the organization, its ongoing work. It also supports this podcast. And if you're interested in taking things to another level, if you've enjoyed the events, if you enjoy this podcast, there is the opportunity to get more involved. Actually, the organization has well, traditionally for years, right, Larry, they've had breakfast at a local diner-type restaurant, local chain Eaton Park.
Yep.
The Homestead location has been the traditional meeting place for members of the organization on early on Wednesday mornings for some time. Well, of course, with COVID, and this pandemic, that has moved online as well. So folks have breakfast over Zoom. And if you want to join as a member and get more information about that, head out to the website, email battleofhomestead@gmail.org. You can find out about how to join that next one, which is coming up just next week on the 28th of October. And they happen every 2 to 3 weeks generally throughout the year. Mm-hmm. So, and if you want to find out more about the organization and maybe even get involved and see what kind of volunteer opportunities there might be, that's the way to do it. And of course, Larry, you take care of our Facebook page. Great place to find out more additional information about what's going on with the organization.
Right. Yes, definitely.
And if you have any suggestions or comments for this podcast and what we're doing here, we always welcome those. Give us a call at 412-326-9435. That's our listener line. So leave us a message. Tell us how we're doing. Tell us what you'd like to hear. Also, we have a new email, comments@essentialworkpodcast.org. That email is in the episode description. Tell us what you'd like to see here, who we should be interviewing perhaps on a future episode. Also, you'll find at our website, essentialworkpodcast.org, if you missed any past episodes of this program, you can check them out there. Our whole list of different podcast platforms, wherever your favorite one is, or you may not have one and like to check one out, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, the links are all right there. And do us a favor, if you head out to Apple Podcasts, be sure to like us there. And, you know, give us a nice review. 5 stars is always good. And that helps other people find out about what we're doing and get a listen to the podcast as well. Also, I'd like to send out some thanks to folks that helped make this happen. Of course, the program committee with the Battle of Homestead Foundation donates their time and energy and ideas. In addition, we have Angela Bachman helps us out with production assistance of all kinds. When we need, she's at thatsoundgirl.com. Brittany Sheets designed our logo. Her website is bsheetscreative.com. And our music theme, it's an original theme composed and recorded by Jason Kendall. JasonKendallProductions.com. You can check out him and all his work there. So with that, it's time for our song selection of the week, tying into our theme as it does. You know, we had our interview with Max Page there. Max and I talked a lot about the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, all the physical structures and buildings that we see out there that were part of that effort back during the Great Depression. And we did touch on as well that artists were also funded by that. And that really ties into what you selected here, Larry, for the song, hasn't it?
Absolutely. One of the very interesting WPA programs was the Federal Writers Project, or the FWP. And about 10,000 people throughout the 1930s were involved in the FWP. And more than 2,900 manuscripts were turned in by writers like Studs Terkel, Gwendolyn Brooks, Mae Swenson, Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, John Cheever, Nelson Algren, Saul Bellow, Eudora Welty. All of these writers later achieved fame as great 20th century American writers.
That's really an incredible list, isn't it?
It is. They were all young and hungry, and this was an opportunity for them to, well, essentially what they did is they collected stories. This wasn't really about their own creative work at this time, but they gathered a background, which later did show up in a lot of their work. The FWP had a folklore section, and it conducted field work and recorded songs, traditions, stories from ordinary people all across the nation. And you say, well, what's the big deal about folklore? At this time, the FWP folklore section program was really represented the first time Americans got to be introduced to themselves. You had radio, of course, as a mass communication medium in the 1920s and early 30s for those who owned a radio.
Sure. Some of you may have heard about radio.
Yep. But in the 1930s, someone living in Maine might never have met anyone from Arizona or Illinois or even 20 miles down the road. A lot of this country was still very isolated. But what the WPA programs did is make America a nation that was much more aware of itself and its diversity.
That's so incredible, Larry, too.
Yeah.
To think about that, there was a time, you know, prior to the interstate highway system, right? Mm-hmm. And prior to people having a phone in every household, right? Where
exactly.
People just didn't communicate with people across the country. So, so this effort really did help people learn about places that they had never been and maybe would never, ever get a chance to visit,
and
right?
There were national newspapers and syndicated
sure,
parts of that. But again, America at that point in the 1930s, really just a century ago, there was a lot of isolation and people simply didn't know really what people were like. They might see them, you know, in newsprint or see some blurry photograph of them or something. But when they started to hear them on radio or they actually started to get information from these writing programs that the WPA and the FWP had, that really gave America just more sense of itself. And again, the incredible diversity that really makes up this nation. And one of the folklore workers for the FWP was a woman named Zora Neale Hurston. She was born in 1891 and grew up in Eatonville, Florida, which was an all-African-American town north of Orlando. She left there at age 13 and went on to get degrees from Morgan State University, Howard University, and Barnard College of Columbia University in New York City, where she was in the right time and place to become an author, anthropologist, filmmaker, and a major figure in the Harlem Renaissance.
That's incredible. She's like a Renaissance woman with that many degrees and all those professions.
Absolutely. And like I say, born turn of the century, a very rural area. Certainly Orlando did not have Disney World at the time. It was not a major metro area at all. Pretty isolated. Zora Neale Hurston, she was the first collector of African-American folklore of the early 1900s. And it is in her work that the world got to hear authentic Black voices in their true social context. Basically, she was collecting and publishing the social history that had not been recognized at all by the academic establishment. So by the time she joins the WPA in 1938, she'd already published several short stories and books. Their Eyes Were Watching God, Mules and Men, Jonas Gourdvine, probably some of the most widely read today. She had produced musical theater shows, music concerts. She'd made documentary films about Southern Black life. At one point, she even wrote straight journalism for the Pittsburgh Courier.
Which is, for those that aren't aware, the Pittsburgh Courier, an African-American newspaper publication here in Pittsburgh for decades.
Yep, definitely. And had a lot of writers like Zora Neale Hurston. Her mission in the late 30s, though, with the Federal Writers Project, was to collect folklore from Black residents of Florida. And here she sings a song that she collected from a juke joint in the countryside. It's called Hallamafack, which is a mythical place, but it fits the fantasy world of the song narrative. And basically, it's sort of a dance song with lyrics. The lyrics start out, "You may leave and go to Hallamafack, but my slow drag will bring you back. You may go, but this will bring you back." It's just something that people did out in rural Florida when she went out and visited them. And this is just part of the enormous folklore collection, songs, stories, tales, jokes, proverbs that she was able to collect and that really became part of our national heritage. And if you'd like more information about this song and the others here in Essential Work, just check the website and you'll find a little bit more about Zora Neale Hurston and the song Hallamafack.
I heard Hallamafack down on the East Coast. I was in a big crowd, and I learned it in the evening during the crowd. And I learned it from the crowd, most exactly from one. I just get in the crowd with the people, and if they sing it, and I listen as best I can, then I start to join in with a phrase or two, and then finally I get so I can sing a verse, and then I keep on till I learn all the songs and all the verses, and then I sing them back to the people until they tell me that I can sing them just like them. And then I take part and I try it out on different people who already know the song until they are quite satisfied that I know it. And then I carry my memory. I learn the song myself and then I can take it with me wherever I go. You may leave and go to Hallamafack, but my slow drag will bring you back. Well, you may go, but this will bring you back. Ah, been in the country, but I moved to town. I'm a tolo shaker from a head on down. Well, you may go, but this will bring you back. Ah, some folks call me a tolo shaker. It's a doggone lie. I'm a backbone breaker. Well, you may go, but this will bring you back. Oh, you like my peaches, but you don't like me. Don't you like my peaches? Don't you shake my tree? Oh, well, you may go, but this will bring you back. A hoodoo, a hoodoo, a hoodoo wagon. My heels all popping and my toenails cracking. Well, you may go, but this will bring you back.
2021 has been a year of transition for all of us. At the Battle of Homestead Foundation, they have discovered new ways to advance their mission of heritage, education, and social action. They expanded their educational outreach to include a weekly online tour of people's history locations through the Charlie's Monday Marker video series, as well as far-reaching discussion of social and economic trends with the podcast Essential Work, The Past, Present, and Future of Jobs. They presented 7 timely online public panels featuring nationally known authors and historians. Topics included workforce shifts from heavy industry to healthcare, the women's suffrage movement, uprooted immigrant neighborhoods, protest songs in today's civil action movements, the 1921 Battle of Blair Mountain, historical roots of today's social philanthropy, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania's world-famous city steps. They establish a professionally archived labor history collection, thousands of documents, photos, recordings, and remembrances of labor history spanning decades. They co-sponsored the Blair Mountain Centennial in West Virginia, honoring a long neglected part of U.S. history with a landmark Labor Day weekend of events. They built a new and more accessible website, which you should check out at battleofhomestead.org. They did all this with help, the essential support of all the individuals like you who enjoyed the programming, appreciate the hard work of the citizens, workers, educators, and historians that make it happen, and value their mission to preserve, interpret, and promote a people's history focused on the significance of the dramatic labor conflict at Homestead, Pennsylvania in 1892. In 2022, they'll present a new round of thought-provoking programming. Membership, along with special donations, is essential to their success. Annual membership is only $30, $20 for retirees or the underemployed, and just $10 for students. Join now at battleofhomestead.org. You can also choose to contribute at any of a number of special donor levels, and donations are tax deductible. Membership also provides multiple free admissions to a variety of historical museums and sites in the greater Pittsburgh area. Check out the details at battleofhomestead.org. As this singular year comes to a close, while we still may have much to be thankful for, we also all see the urgent necessity of doing more to share our progressive labor history to a wider audience and inspire a new generation of activists and organizers. Your membership and engagement ensures that the Battle of Homestead Foundation will continue to do just that. Show your support today at battleofhomestead.org. In solidarity, BHF thanks you and wishes you good health, positive spirits, and both peaceful and joyous days ahead.